WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first half of our show, civil liberties lawyer David Cole told us why he thinks America's new anti-terrorism security measures compromise our civil liberties. My guest, Douglas Kamek, disagrees. Kamek is a professor of constitutional law and the dean of the law school at the Catholic University of America. From 1985 to 89, he served in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., heading the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. Since September 11th, he's been asked by Congress to address issues related to foreign affairs, authority of the president, national security, and the drafting of the Patriot Act. Let's start with total information awareness, the program which would enable the government to get access to virtually all computerized information about Americans. Do we really want the government to have the right to see every aspect of our private life as it's been recorded electronically, our medical records, our phone calls, our purchases, the books we've taken out of the library and rented at the video store? Do you think there's potential here for invasion of privacy?
Of course there is, and for that reason, we need to get serious about updating the concept of privacy. The concept of privacy as it exists in the law right now is a very underdeveloped concept. Most of it is associated with forms of intimacy that the Supreme Court has protected for a long time. The rest of our jurisprudence is related to information is associated with our political associations and things of that nature, or finally, that are protected under those aspects of the Constitution that protect us from unlawful or unreasonable searches and seizure in the criminal context. In other words, we have to update the jurisprudence. We have to fully articulate what it is that we're willing to keep private at all costs and what it is that we're willing to sacrifice in any given circumstance for basic national security and personal safety.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Where do you draw the line between what you're willing to sacrifice in hopes that it will give you a more basic safety and what wouldn't you be willing to give up in this age of terrorism?
I do think that there has to be a relatively rigorous showing of probable cause when you're starting to invade bank records and tax records and phone records of a private citizen. And, of course, those are the standards that have applied in our criminal justice system, and those are the standards that have applied in the foreign intelligence area. There is a special court, as you may know, for the obtaining of warrants to do surveillance for individuals who are suspected of being agents of foreign nations or of terrorist organizations. But a showing of probable cause has to be made before an independent judge, and a warrant has to issue before any of that information is available. I, for one, think that's the right balance. Others may disagree, but I think in this circumstance, I think that's where I would draw the line comfortably.
Well, how is probable cause written into total information awareness as it stands now?
Well, probable cause exists as a constitutional standard. It can't be escaped either by federal administrative or executive regulation. Indeed, Congress can't pass a statute authorizing total information awareness and repeal probable cause or repeal the protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. So the short answer is it's written into our Constitution, and that body of Supreme Court opinions which gives meaning to the Constitution would be examined to govern and to confine a total information awareness. I think all of us are for privacy so long as that privacy is understood as not absolute when there are countervailing security interests that are constitutionally proven and demonstrated. This is how we conduct criminal investigations. This is how we should maintain the balance in the national security field as well.
Do you feel we have adequate protections with the total information awareness campaign, adequate protections that the government won't be spying on dissidents or critics. After all, in the Nixon administration, we know that the FBI was spying on anti-war activists, on civil rights activists. What protections do we have?
Well, those are very serious concerns and sensitive concerns. The protections that we have, again, are constitutional in nature, and unfortunately, all protections that we construct tend to be after the fact, so that we live in a world where if someone wants to disregard the Constitution, if someone wants to disregard warrant requirements, if someone wants to misapply authority to perfectly legitimate First Amendment and associational activity, they can only be stopped and reprimanded or fined or imprisoned after the fact. Be that as it may, it is important for us to have a robust theory of constitutional privacy as it exists out of the Fourth Amendment. And it is also important for Congress, as it conducts oversight of total awareness programs, to write these limitations further into statutory law. One example, Terry, this was done in the USA Patriot Act in two different ways. One, the expanded authority was subject to very carefully limited sunset provisions, so the expanded authority is only going to exist for the next 18 months or so, and then Congress is going to reexamine it. And also, there's a specific provision that says those who use the expanded authority and they misuse it are subject to fine and civil lawsuit. I think it's important to have both constitutional and statutory protections.
Now, we're talking about the importance of being sensitive to civil liberties in the handling of the Total Information Awareness Program. The head of the program, and in fact the father of the program, is John Poindexter, the former National Security Advisor under President Reagan, who you also served. And a lot of people are concerned that, you know, Poindexter was convicted of 5 counts, including lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal. His conviction was overturned on a technicality. But, I mean, the question becomes, is he the person you want to trust with all the sensitive information about our private lives?
Well, I have to believe that John Poindexter's in the position he's in because he's demonstrated to people in the Pentagon that, first of all, he's very capable and intelligent, and second, that he can produce a prototype of an information system can then be presented to the Secretary of Defense and further presented to members of Congress before one is going to have a sign-off, as it were, as to whether or not this is a program that should become operational.
But do you think it's a good judgment call to put somebody who defied all these kind of oversight things during Iran-Contra?
Well, of course, I was in the Justice Department at the time Iran-Contra was being litigated, and so one of the things that I recognize about that dispute is that it had many sides. There was a pretty vibrant debate at the time over what the respective authority of the President and the Congress was with regard to various international situations in terms of what the President can do in terms of raising money from foreign nations, what the President could do in terms of authorizing discussions in the international context that Congress may disagree with. That's a pretty difficult constitutional line to draw with a good deal of precision. And so while I'm not at all justifying anything that a criminal prosecutor prosecuted John Poindexter for, I do think it was probably more of a complicated question than sometimes our historical memory of it lets on. I think John Poindexter is a capable man. I think he's going to be well supervised in this.
My guest is constitutional expert Douglas Kamek. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Kamek. He's dean and professor at the Law School of Catholic University of America. He's an expert in constitutional law. We're talking about the post-9/11 security measures that have been or are being put into place, and these are measures which he supports. We're also talking on today's show with civil liberties lawyer David Cole. One of the things he's concerned about is the right of immigrants. The Patriot Act, he says, gives the Attorney General unprecedented power to lock up any immigrant that he certifies as a suspected terrorist. And these immigrants are subject to potentially indefinite detention. And suspected terrorism is broadly defined in the Patriot Act, the act that was passed shortly after September 11th. Cole is also concerned that immigrants are being detained without letting them know what the evidence against them is. So it becomes impossible to defend yourself. Are you concerned about this, too?
Well, I don't think either is true. And so I would respectfully disagree with Professor Cole on both points. On the first point, I think the best evidence of what has actually happened is to look at the numbers of people detained on immigration violations and what's happened to them. Again, I think the Attorney General has been quite forthright in saying that anybody who has been detained has had access to counsel. Now, it is true that not all of them who have been detained on terrorist-related suspicions have had open proceedings. But that doesn't mean that they have been involved in proceedings where they haven't had access to counsel. The Attorney General has been explicit that everyone who has been detained on immigration charges or terrorist-related charges has been given counsel if they couldn't afford it, or have been allowed to pursue private counsel if they could.
But getting counsel doesn't answer the question of whether they're told what the evidence against them is.
Well, I have to believe that any counsel who graduated from any fine law school is going to ask that question, and that's going to be the first question they're going to ask, and it's going to pursue a writ of habeas corpus relatively quickly if there's no answer forthcoming. So if, in fact, in individual cases, that answer hasn't been forthcoming, I suspect there has been some fault in terms of individual representation, but I don't think it would be fair to attribute that to the Attorney General. The Attorney General, after all, can't argue both sides. His job is to enforce the immigration statutes.
So you're disagreeing with David Cole. You're saying that evidence like
actually,
this isn't...
Actually, I just don't think it's correct.
You're saying evidence like this isn't being withheld.
Right.
Now, you have said that you're hoping that the public, the press, the courts, other people in government will be watchdogs of any new legislation or security measures to prevent any violations of civil liberties. Now, one program that was met with a pretty negative reaction, and I think that program has just kind of disappeared, is TIPS, the Terrorist Information and Preventive System. This is the system where people were basically asked to keep their eyes open and inform on any neighbors or the pizza delivery man or the taxi driver that seems to be doing something suspicious. What's your understanding of what happened to this? Is it just kind of like disappeared because of bad public reaction?
Well, I don't think it was the most serious building block in our protection against Al-Qaeda or the terrorist threat, so that it was something that was lightly suggested in the first place, and then secondly, easily foregone when it did have some negative reaction. It's a very distasteful thing to contemplate. Terry, you'll remember that part of the program was also coupled with a part of the program that was very successful, and that was a program that asked individuals who fit a certain template, a certain age range, a certain travel pattern, a template that was similar to that of the 19 hijackers on September 11th, and that voluntarily asked them to come forward and supply information. And that program was very successful. And there are, I believe, a number of ongoing prosecutions in New York and on the West Coast that are directly related to the information that was obtained out of those voluntary programs. And I don't think that's at all uncomfortable. I think, we just lived here in Washington, D.C. for a month under the scourge of a sniper who was killing people at will. And one of the things we very much wanted on our 9/11 phone lines was information about anything, suspicious-looking cars, suspicious-looking individuals, people who we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And in fact, it was that information and it was that public-spiritedness of a truck driver and others that ultimately led to the arrest of the snipers.
Are there any final thoughts or points you'd like to leave us with?
Well, here's two sort of interrelated points.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I was privileged to help the Department of Justice with was its initial thinking on the fashioning of military tribunals and the rules and regulations that now have been put into place for those tribunals. I think this is a very important avenue to have in the context of a war on terrorism. And if there's one place where I think that constitutional liberty and national security has gotten intermixed in terms of the wrong balance, it's in the assignment of the Zacharias Moussaoui case to the normal criminal justice process. Mr. Moussaoui, as you know, is in the normal criminal process in the Eastern District of Virginia. His claim is basically that he is a sympathizer with al-Qaeda, but he had nothing to do with the 9/11 planning. What we do know from parallel proceedings taking place in Hamburg, Germany, of individuals who were part of the Hamburg cell, and from the interrogations of Ramzi bin al-Shaba, who was captured in Pakistan and who's one of the principal financiers of al-Qaeda, is that Mr. Moussaoui is tied in much more closely with 9/11 planning than he would want us to believe. Now, the problem is that if, by virtue of the fact that he's been put in the normal criminal justice process, he is entitled to all of the constitutional protections that one gets once that criminal justice process is launched, including, of course, the right to directly confront witnesses. Well, how does he directly confront witnesses like Ramzi bin al-Shaba, who are being held, properly so, in classified locations and whose interrogation would be jeopardized if he was to be brought to the Eastern District of Virginia as a witness either on behalf of the government or, for that matter, on behalf of Mr. Moussaoui, who has a Sixth Amendment right to have access to witnesses. So I think it's very important that as we move along in this war on terrorism, we recognize that that there's a fundamental difference between individuals who are being held as enemy combatants and individuals who are being charged with a crime. Individuals who are being held as enemy combatants are people that have been snatched off battlefields or involved in the planning of attacks against us, and they can be held for the length of the war. Individuals who are going to be prosecuted for a crime have to be prosecuted expeditiously. They have to be given rights of counsel, and they have to be given all the full constitutional protections that are associated with the criminal system. So I would hope that the Attorney General, as he proceeds, would be careful about drawing that line to make sure that the right process is initiated for each individual that comes to his attention.
Douglas Kamek, thank you very much for talking with us.
Very good to be with you.
Douglas Kamek is the dean of the Catholic University of America's Law School. He served in the Justice Department during the Reagan and Bush senior administrations. Earlier in the show, we heard from civil liberties lawyer David Cole, who believes America's new security measures threaten our civil liberties. This is Fresh Air.